call upon Brother Roger to give us the words on Samuel called unto Yahweh, and Yahweh sent thunder.
Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, on the occasion of our introductory study just a few nights ago, we began our consideration of the life of Samuel the seer in the 9th chapter, when he was commanded by God to anoint a young man called Saul. And we found by way of exhortation that there was a remarkable spirit in the old man, that when he saw Saul before him, who was evidently one who lacked spiritual ability or even practical common sense, that he did not just anoint him as Yahweh had commanded him to do, but he honoured and esteemed and respected him above and beyond that which was necessary, because he himself was truly a humble man. And we found the spectacle of a prophet who, for all his greatness, had no thoughts of self-vindication. He truly had developed that spirit of humility that characterised him in his greatness as Samuel the seer. And we made the point in our opening study that all of our considerations, God willing, over the course of this week, are a reflection upon a man who already has come to oldness of age. Our studies began in the 1st of Samuel chapter 9. And we're actually told in the 1st of Samuel chapter 8 and verse 1 that Samuel was old. And the remarkable thing that we find is that the bulk of the information that is given to us about the life of this man takes place after that statement. It is essentially a consideration of the words and life experiences of an old man. And we need to remember that in terms of our understanding of that which the record presents unto us. They are the words and the thoughts of an old man. I want you to think about that as we go through these studies as they remain. Well, having anointed Saul in the 9th chapter, we come then by way of consideration today to the story of the 1st of Samuel chapter 12, but we're going to pick up the record from the last two verses of the previous chapter, which give us the context, the 1st of Samuel chapter 11 and verse 14. And there the record says that Samuel said to the people, "Come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." Now, why did he ask the people to go with him to Gilgal? Well, of course, it was at Gilgal in Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10 that the people of Israel had rolled away the reproach of Egypt. But they'd done more than that, hadn't they? Really, you see, at Gilgal, Israel had learned to make a new start before their God. And that's what Samuel wanted them to do here and now. Gilgal stood for the place where the nation had begun afresh before their God. Samuel says, "Come with me back to Gilgal. Here's an opportunity," says Samuel, "to begin anew with this changing from the era of the judges to that of the monarchy. There's an opportunity to begin life afresh before God." And so he says, verse 14, "Let us go and renew the kingdom there." And the word renew means to rebuild in the sense of cutting and polishing. And you see, the principle that comes out of that verse is this. It's a lovely principle, really. You see, here's a man who's about to pass over the reins of government. He's an old man. He's about to see another younger man take his place. But Samuel was ever one to find opportunity for the positive work of building the people of God. Even if it was a time of his own resignation, he would seize that opportunity if it gave him the time to build that nation in positive values. He said, "Come with me to Gilgal and let's renew the kingdom. Let's begin again. Let's take this opportunity to start life afresh before God." Samuel wasn't worried about himself, brothers and sisters, but he had a loving care for his people. He wanted them to take that opportunity. And so we're told in the 15th verse that all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before Yahweh in Gilgal. And there they sacrificed sacrifices of peace offerings before Yahweh. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. It says that they offered sacrifices of peace offerings. Now, the peace offerings are a very interesting offering, and there are two things that we believe are pertinent to this particular episode with regard to the law concerning peace offerings. And the first thing is this, that the peace offering uniquely was offered with leaven. It was offered with leaven in the bread which accompanied it. And the principle that was therein contained was this, that fellowship with God, which is the peace offering, is never ever on the basis of human perfection. Far from it, there's leaven involved, even in our desires for fellowship with God. And I believe that Samuel wanted to remind the nation of that. That we'll never ever achieve human perfection if that is the criteria for our fellowship with God. But there's another principle about the peace offering that's interesting, and that's this. That the fat of the peace offering was always burnt upon the fat of a burnt offering. In fact, the law explicitly tells us that the fat of the peace offering was taken and placed on top of the fat of the burnt offering upon the altar. And what is thereby being expressed is this principle, that despite our shortcomings, God is prepared to extend fellowship to those who, although sinful, leaven is present, are nevertheless prepared to dedicate themselves to Him with all their heart, burnt offering. On that basis, says God, one can find fellowship with Him. I believe that Samuel really wanted to impress those principles upon the nation. Notice at the end of verse 15 it says, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Actually, the Septuagint translation changes the word Saul and inserts the word Samuel. The Septuagint translation says, and there Samuel and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And whether or not that is a correct translation, it doesn't really matter. I believe the spirit is correct, that there was no hateful spirit of envy or bitterness in Samuel. I believe that he likewise participated in this moment of great rejoicing in the nation. Samuel didn't hold back. He rejoiced with the nation. You know how hard that would be. If you'd governed a people for 30 years, how would you find it stepping aside for another younger, lesser man? There was no self-pride in Samuel, was there? Only a desire to do that which was right for his nation. Now we notice in chapter 12 and verse 1, as Samuel begins what we might term his resignation speech proper, that Samuel said unto all Israel, behold, he says, I have hearkened unto your voice and all that ye said unto me, and I have made a king over you. I have hearkened unto your voice. You know, do you think that's true? Had he really hearkened unto the people's voice? Well, in a sense he had. And in another sense he hadn't. See, if you come back to chapter 8, we see exactly what really happened. In the first of Samuel chapter 8 and verse 4, it says, then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, behold, thou art old and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto Yahweh. You know, the margin says that the thing was evil in the eyes of Samuel, as well we might imagine that it would be. In fact, Josephus tells us that he lay sleepless all that night. So distressed was he by that request of the nation that a king should be placed over them. You know, brothers and sisters, I can think of three reasons why this matter of the request of the nation for kingship was deeply displeasing to Samuel. Three principal reasons. Here's the first one. The first reason why he was displeased was that the reason given by the nation for their desire for a king in verse 5 was, thy sons walk not in thy ways. That would have displeased Samuel. To think that his own sons were the cause for the nation's request. You know, there's a powerful lesson in that, isn't there? for all fathers and the truth. How terrible if our work in the truth should be undone by our offspring. Would that have not displeased Samuel? And the second reason that we believe that it would have displeased Samuel, because in asking for a king, they were in reality rejecting God who was their king. And Samuel's going to make that very point clear in the 1st of Samuel chapter 12. That he felt that in asking for a king, they did not appreciate that God was their king. That was displeasing to Samuel. And not only had they asked for a king, but you'll notice in verse 5 it says, "Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." And the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." But in the 1st of Samuel chapter 7 and verse 15, the previous chapter, that was Samuel's job. It says that he judged Israel all the days of his life. And now they're asking for a king to judge us. What did they think he'd been doing for 30 years? As Brother Tennant says in his book on the man David, Samuel felt the cold blast of thanklessness from the nation. He felt that very deeply. I don't believe he felt it in the sense of trying to vindicate himself, just the loneliness and the hurt of a man who after 30 or 40 years of wonderful labour had been brushed aside by his nation. How would you feel? How would you feel? Now notice what the record says in the 1st of Samuel chapter 8 and verse 7. "And Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people." Verse 9, "Now therefore hearken unto their voice." Verse 22, "And Yahweh said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice and make them king." So you see, when in the 1st of Samuel chapter 12 and verse 1, Samuel says, "I've hearkened unto your voice," he hadn't really hearkened to their voice. He'd hearkened to God's voice. Because three times it was God that had said, "You listen to their voice and make them a king." That was the only reason that Samuel had done that. The one and only reason was not because of the people, but because above everything else, Samuel was a man who always heard God's voice in his life. That was the supreme principle of his life. You know, there's been some doubt as to the meaning of Samuel's name. It's been suggested that Samuel, Shemuel, comes from the Hebrew Shem, meaning a name. And yet it's very clear when you consider the narrative that Samuel really comes from the Hebrew word Shema, Shema El. The great Shema, "Hear, O Israel." Except Strong's Concordance tells us that in the particular form that the word is found in Samuel's name, it's in the passive. So that it doesn't mean "hear God," it means "heard of God." He was called that by his mother, wasn't he? Because she'd prayed to God and she'd been heard of God and the fact that he'd granted a son. You know, the twin watchwords of Samuel's life were "hear God," Shema El, and "heard of God," Shemuel. And those were the two pillars of Samuel's life. That he always heard God's voice, and that in return God always heard his voice when it was lifted up in his prayer. That was what Samuel went down for in the nation. And so when he says in chapter 12 verse 1, "I've hearkened to your voice," he'd really only ever done so because he'd listened to God's voice. And when God said to do it, then Samuel was prepared to do it. You know, there's a lesson, isn't there, in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 12 and verse 1. And the lesson is this. That sometimes in the truth there are demands made upon us which are humbling to ourselves. Sometimes we're asked to do things that might cause us to perhaps step aside for another. Or to support the work where other people are more prominently involved than ourselves. It's always hard to do that, isn't it? Samuel never ever hesitated to do that if the divine instruction was that it should be so. And so he says in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 12, verse 1, "I've hearkened unto your voice in all that ye said unto me, and I've made you a king over you." And he hadn't just made him, brothers and sisters. He made him, and he would support that king through thick and thin to the very end. He didn't just anoint Saul, you know, brothers and sisters. If you read the record carefully, you'll find that Samuel for all the fact that he might have warned and rebuked Saul, he stood behind that youthful monarch through every circumstance. He was wholehearted in his support. It's a lovely spirit in that old man. A lovely spirit. There was no trace of self in him. And so he says in the second verse, "And now, behold, the king walketh before you. And I am old and grey-headed, and behold, my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my childhood unto this day." I'm old and grey-headed, he says. You know, we're told in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 31 that the hoary head is a crown of glory if he be in the way of righteousness. And that indeed was true of the prophet, wasn't it? The hoary head, incidentally, the word grey-headed comes from the same Hebrew root as the hoary head. The hoary head is a crown of glory if he be in the way of righteousness. Wasn't that true of Samuel? And we're also told in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 32 that Israel were to rise up before the hoary head and have respect for those who are old in the truth. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why Samuel mentions this on this occasion. What he's saying is that he was one who had the experience and maturity of life that they ought to respect what he had to say. And perhaps there was another reason as well. Now if you come to Psalm 71... we have that same phrase, old and grey-headed, used by another man at the time of his own old age. It's the end of the life of David. He's about to hand over the reins of government to his own son, Solomon. He's about to lift up his voice and to give that wonderful prayer of Psalm 72, "Give the king thy judgments, O God," and to step down from the throne. And before he does so, in Psalm 71, he pens these words. Notice the ninth verse. "Cast me not off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength faileth." Verse 18. "Now also when I'm old and grey-headed, O God, forsake me not." And you know, it seems to me in those words that there's almost a sense of the failing of life's powers. They're the words of an old man who feels the power of life slipping away from him. Can you sense that? "Cast me not off in old age when my strength faileth, when I'm old and grey-headed." There's a real tinge of sadness in those words, isn't there? As Samuel stands before the nation and says, "I'm old and grey-headed." He truly felt that he had very little power left now to give unto the nation. As we come back to the first of Samuel chapter 12 and verse 2, he says, and not only was he old and grey-headed, but he says, "Behold, my sons are with you." And there was another tinge of sadness, because of course his sons hadn't lived up to the principles of their father. Perhaps the phrase, "my sons are with you," indicates that he was a grown man, that if his sons were grown up to maturity, then he must indeed be an old man. Perhaps also the words convey, as would appear to be the case, that Samuel was saying that despite the weakness of his sons, that he hadn't committed the same error as Eli, who restrained not his sons. And that the implication of the phrase here, "my sons are with you," is indicating this, that he had deprived his sons of public office. He had reduced them to the level of commoners. He had left it for the people to judge concerning his sons, and that if they needed to be judged as in some way, then he left it for the nation to deal with his sons as they saw fit. "My sons are with you. They're no longer ruling," he says. "I've taken them away from that office." The sons might have been bad, but Samuel wasn't a weak man. He wasn't swayed by family considerations. He was strong enough and wise enough to see the weakness even in his own boys. And he says at the end of that verse, he says, "I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day." And I suppose we would have to say that what those words are telling us is that Samuel, in his own quiet way, was claiming absolute consistency of dedication as a leader. consistency in love. Isn't that what the truth's all about? I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day, grey-headed. Consistency of dedication throughout life. You know, that's one of the most wonderful things that we could ever hope to see in the truth. The person who started off life with all the enthusiasm of the truth and even an oldness of age, that we can see that light burning. That's a wonderful encouragement in life. And Samuel was just such a man. He goes on to say in the third verse, "Behold," he says, "here I am. Witness against me before Yahweh and before his anointed, the king, Saul. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose ass have I taken?" You know where he gets that phrase from? "Whose ass have I taken?" He actually takes it from the life of Moses. It's quite interesting. If you come back to Numbers chapter 16, Numbers chapter 16 is, we believe, where Samuel is drawing on this occasion. It's interesting because Numbers chapter 16, of course, is the story of the leadership challenge to Moses in the days of Korah, Dathan and Abiram. And they felt that it was time that they had a share in the leadership. They suggested that Moses took too much upon himself and that there were other people just as capable of leading the nation. Can you imagine how Moses felt on that occasion? Do you think Moses ever led the nation because he thought he ought to have been the leader? You know, it's often true, isn't it, in ecclesial life, certainly in biblical times, that those that were the greatest leaders of God's people were the ones that didn't want to be the leaders. Moses never wanted to be a leader. But he was who he was because of his own character. And now men are standing up in the nation saying, "Who do you think you are leading the nation?" And they began to query the integrity of Moses. And Moses, in anger at what they had done that was unrighteous, says in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 15, it says, "Moses was very wroth and said unto Yahweh, Respect not thou their offering. I have not taken one ass from them, neither have I hurt one of them." And there's a cry from the heart, wrenched out of Moses because of the injustice of what those men said. And another man stands up now, an oldness of age, in the first of Samuel 12, and he felt just the same. Just the same as Moses of old. Felt that same pain as he was now to stand aside. "Whose ass have I taken?" cries Samuel. You know, there's an ironical twist to those words. Because, you see, the claim of leadership in Numbers 16 was being advanced against Moses by a man called Korah. And the irony of the occasion of the first of Samuel chapter 12 is that if you like to take a note of Numbers 26 verse 11 and the first of Chronicles chapter 6 verses 22 to 28, which we won't turn up, but you might like to take a note of, Numbers 26 verse 11 and the first of Chronicles chapter 6 verses 22 and 28, you'll find that Samuel is of the line of Korah. Isn't that a strange twist in life? It was Korah who challenged Moses for the leadership. And now a man who is of the line of Korah is the leader. He feels just the way as Moses did of old in terms of challenging the nation concerning his own personal integrity. And as we come back to the first of Samuel chapter 12, you'll notice that the third verse goes on to say this. It says, "Behold, here I am, witness against me before Yahweh and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose ass have I taken?" And then he goes on to say this. He says, "Whom have I defrauded, or whom have I oppressed, or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith, that I will restore it you?" And in those words, those three phrases about defrauding and oppressing and receiving bribes, you'll find on the basis of Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 19 that Samuel is claiming purity of character as a judge. That's what he's claiming in the balance of that verse. He's claiming purity of character as a judge. That he'd never ever accepted anything in the form of money or bribes or commissions that might blind his eyes or pervert his heart. He was pure in the way in which he judged the nation. Deuteronomy chapter 16 verse 19. And so he was. He'd never, ever done that. The fourth verse goes on to say that the people responded in this remarkable way when they said, Thou hast not defrauded us, nor oppressed us, neither hast thou taken aught of any man's hand. They completely agreed with the prophet. They were witness to his claim of personal purity in life. Because his watchword in life had ever been that he was prepared to hear God's voice. And he'd hold fast to that, whatever the consequences might be. You notice in verse 5, he really presses that point, doesn't he? He says, he said unto them, Yahweh is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that ye have not found aught in my hand. And they answered, he's witness. And when it says there that he says that you've not found aught in my hand, I suppose that what he's really therefore claiming, in an overall sense in these first five verses, is he's saying that he had absolute integrity. Now to my mind, those are the three words that to me are what Samuel's really talking about in these first five verses. He says, look, he says, I've been consistent in life, verse 2. Consistent in dedication. He says, I've been pure in character, verse 3. And I've had absolute integrity of principle in all my dealings, verse 5. And so he had. And so powerful was that witness that you notice at the end of the verse, they answered, not he is witness, the words he is are not there in the original. He said, Yahweh is witness against you that you've not found aught in my hand. And they said, witness. There's almost a spirit of meekness in the way in which the people acquiesce. So powerful was that claim, and so unchallengeable was it. Now you see, brothers and sisters, these are not the words of a man of pride. They're not the words of a man who was pressing to vindicate himself. You might think they were at first sight. They're not. If you come to Proverbs chapter 21... Proverbs chapter 21. We're told these words in the 28th verse. A false witness, says Proverbs 21, verse 28, a false witness shall perish. But the man that heareth speaketh constantly. That's a little awkward in the authorized version, but Rotherhams translates the phrase as follows. A false witness shall perish, but the man who hearkeneth with abiding effect shall speak. The man who hearkeneth with abiding effect shall speak. Or as the Amplified Bible puts it, the words of a man who hears attentively will endure and be unchallenged. And there's the first of Samuel, chapter 12, verses 1 to 5. The words of a man who hears attentively will endure and be unchallenged. And the whole nation was witness to the absolute integrity of this man. They couldn't challenge one thing that he'd done. Why? Because he'd always heard attentively the voice of God in his life. Now, along comes a man in the New Testament who's about to see some of his friends for the last time. In a sense, he's going to resign. It's a farewell speech. He's got other things to do. They're his last words of warning to this particular group of people. We refer, of course, to the apostle. And in Acts chapter 20, he gives a farewell speech. And this is what he says in that chapter. He says in Acts chapter 20, verses 18 and 25, he says, I have been with you at all seasons. Samuel had said, from my childhood unto this day. Ye all among whom I've gone, said the apostle in the 25th verse. And Samuel had said, I've walked before you. And the claim of consistency of dedication that was characteristic of Samuel in the 1st of Samuel chapter 12 and verse 2 is echoed in the very appeal of the apostle in Acts chapter 20 verses 18 and 25. Where else could the apostle turn to but the famous resignation speech of Samuel as he farewelled those amongst whom he had served in the ecclesias of Asia? And Samuel in the 3rd verse had said, "Whose ox have I taken? Or whose ass have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith?" And the Apostle Paul stands up in Acts chapter 20, verses 33 to 35, and says, "I have coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel." Whose ox have I taken, in a sense, is the cry of the apostle, as he claims on the same basis as Samuel that he'd been absolutely pure in his dealings amongst those people. Incidentally, by way of digression, this statement here, "I have coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel," we believe is a somewhat uncharacteristic statement in the middle of a speech, and we believe the reason why the apostle mentions it on that occasion was that he was under intense pressure from the Judaizers about his real motives for collecting the money for the Jerusalem Poor Fund. Because at the time of Acts chapter 20, he's just about to embark on his journey back to Jerusalem, and he's got all these bags of money with him. And the Judaizers had been very busy in the ecclesias saying he's actually embezzling the money. It was an absolutely unjust claim. And the apostle stands up and says, in Acts chapter 20, from the very spirit of Samuel, "I've coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel." Might even be more to it than that too, because when you read those words, "no man's silver or gold or apparel," they're vaguely familiar too, aren't they, from the Old Testament. Who was the man who coveted a wedge of gold and some pieces of silver and a goodly Babylonish piece of apparel? And we believe that the apostle in Acts chapter 20 was not only alluding to the speech of Samuel, but also to the story of Achan. And his appeal to the Judaizers in Acts 20 was, "I'm not the one that's the troubler of Israel." That's the impact, we believe, of his allusion in Acts chapter 20. And Samuel had also said, in the 5th verse here of chapter 12, "Yahweh is witness, and is anointed as witness this day, that ye have not found aught in my hand." And Acts chapter 20, verse 26, the apostle says, "Wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men." There's a real matching of spirit there, isn't there? There's no doubt whatsoever that the apostle saw himself in the day of his own trials as somewhat experiencing the problems of Samuel in the day of the resignation speech of Samuel. Well, there's an exhortation that comes out of this, isn't there? You see, what Samuel had been claiming was integrity. Not that he might vindicate himself, but because he wanted them to listen carefully to the words of his message that would follow. He wanted them to listen to the words of a righteous man. He wanted them to realise that which he was going to unfold in the balance of this chapter was not designed to promote himself, but it was truly wise counsel for the nation. So he presses the matter of his personal integrity. You know, that's got to be one of the greatest exhortations in our life in the truth. You know, integrity is a lost word today, isn't it? Personal integrity. Do you have that? Would you say that you're a person with integrity? It says in a psalm about those that swear to their own hurt and change not. Are you like that? Lots of people in the truth that espouse principles and then decide later on that they're not convenient. So they change to suit themselves. That's not integrity. We're exposed, brothers and sisters, to a world outside where all sorts of underhand dealings take place. There's many times when saints are hard-pressed that they might in some way become involved with certain transactions in life that are not quite right. Are you a person of integrity in all your dealings? both within and without of the ecclesia. You know, I can really believe that those people would have listened to Samuel that day because they knew that he was a man of integrity, and there's nothing worse in ecclesial life than a person that stands up to exhort us who hasn't got integrity. It's very hard to listen to a person who's speaking to us about the need for humility if we know that they have a problem of promoting themselves. It's very hard to listen to a person who's expounding the virtues of dedication when we know they have difficulty in attending little more than the Sunday meeting themselves. It's very hard to listen to someone waxing eloquent about the preaching of the truth, but they never do manage to get along to pamphlet distributions. Integrity. You got that? That's the lesson from the life of Samuel. Well, I can see I've gone far too long on the first few verses of this chapter, and therefore we're going to have to perhaps skim through the next section. Now, in the first of Samuel chapter 12 and verses 6 to 11, we have a different section which we might just quickly summarise and move on to the latter part of the chapter. What we really have here in this next section we might describe as the cycle of the judges. It's a very well-known cycle, and what Samuel is really doing in these next verses is he's going back over the experience chapter 12 and verses 6 to 11, we have a different section which we might just quickly summarise and move on to the latter part of the chapter. What we really have here in this next section we might describe as the cycle of the judges. It's a very well-known cycle, and what Samuel is really doing in these next verses is he's going back over the experience of the nation in the epoch which has now come to an end. The epoch of the judges. In verse 6 it says that Samuel said unto the people, Yahweh that advanced Moses and Aaron, and that brought up your fathers out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore, he says, stand still that I may reason with you before Yahweh of all the righteous acts of Yahweh which he did to you and to your fathers. When Jacob was come unto Egypt and your fathers cried unto Yahweh, and here's this section here, then Yahweh sent Moses and Aaron, he sent deliverers. Verse 9, and when they forgot Yahweh their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the host of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them, and they cried unto Yahweh, and said, we've sinned because we've forsaken Yahweh and have served Balaam and Ashtaroth, but now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies, and we will serve thee. And Yahweh sent Jerubbaal, and Beden, and Jephthah, and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and ye dwelled safe. So you see, what we have in the verses 6 to 11 is Samuel's recollections of the main lessons from the epoch of the judges. Because, of course, he was the last judge. What he's saying is, he says, just as Moses gave a final address concerning the experiences of the nation up to his time, and just as Joshua, in Joshua 24, gave his own contemplations upon the experience of the nation, so now Samuel says, look, he says, I'm the last judge. And I want to review for you the principal lessons of the era of the judges, because it's very important that you get to understand them. He says, look, in the last few hundred years, in the times of the judges of which I've been the last, Israel has been through a cycle in life. There were times when they heard God. And then having been sent deliverers, they would forget God, they would forsake his ways, and they would go a-whoring after other gods. And as a result of that, sin would come into the nation. And as a result of that sin, they would have suffering brought upon them in the form of various oppressors that God brought upon the nation. And as soon as that oppression came upon the nation, says Samuel, then of course the nation would cry unto Yahweh and make supplication to him, repent of their evil, that they might seek God again, and he would send them deliverers. And the cycle would go on again. Now he says, that's been the story of the life of the judges. He says, you must understand that. It's very important to understand that. In fact, you'll notice at the bottom there that this cycle is alluded to in Judges chapter 2, the first of Samuel chapter 12, Nehemiah chapter 9, Psalm 106. They're all recollections of that same cycle of life. And the two principal lessons, of course, the two principal lessons of the era of the judges that Samuel wished to draw their attention to was this. Very simple, really. Sin brings suffering. Supplication brings salvation. Now he says, you must learn that. That's all you've got to learn. But you must learn that. You've got to learn that turning to God and hearing his voice is the only basis for security in life. He says, I know that. He says, there's the whole history of the judges spread out before you in a few simple verses. If you can't understand that, he says, you'll never find happiness in life. You know, in the 11th verse, just jumping quickly to that, he says that Yahweh sent the following deliverers. It says that he sent Jerubbaal and Beden and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and ye dwelled safe. Now, Jerubbaal, of course, is Gideon, isn't it? Gideon fought against the Midianites. We're told that in Judges 6, verse 33, and chapter 7, verses 22 to 23. Gideon fought against the Midianites, and although the battle was held in the middle of the land, the Midianites, of course, as a people, came from the south of Israel. And then it says that God sent Bedan. Now, who's Bedan? Well, the Septuagint translation and the Syriac and the Arabic manuscripts all read the word Barak instead of Bedan. And it's rendered as such by the Jerusalem Bible, by the Amplified Bible, by Moffat's, by the Revised Version, by a number of other translations, that Bedan is in fact Barak. Should be rendered that way according to a number of manuscripts. Now, the interesting thing about Barak in Judges chapter 4 and verses 22 to 24 is that he delivered Israel from the Canaanites. Now, the Canaanites were in various places, but we're specifically told that in the days of Barak that the Canaanites dwelled in the north of the land because their capital, where Jabin was Hazor. So they were a principal enemy to the north of Israel. Midian was an enemy to the south. And then it says that God sent Jephthah. And Jephthah, of course, according to Judges chapter 11, verses 32 to 33, delivered Israel out of the hands of the Ammonites. Now the Ammonites dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. They were an enemy to the east of Israel. Finally, the verse says that God sent Samuel. And we know from the 1st of Samuel, chapter 7 and verse 13, that Samuel's role as a judge was to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And the Philistines dwelled on the coastal plain, didn't they? They were an enemy on the western side of Israel. So we have the Midianites to the south, and the Canaanites to the north, and the Ammonites to the east, and the Philistines to the west. And the verse says that he delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and so he has. North, south, east, west. And therefore we believe that these four judges are taken in that representative way to show the completeness of God's deliverance on every side from the hand of their enemies. If they could only but learn to turn to God and make supplications to him, then indeed they would find peace and happiness. Seems funny, doesn't it, in verse 11, for Samuel to make reference to himself, that God had sent Samuel. But then, of course, don't forget that his role as the judge, in a sense, is now finished. He's handed over the reins of government in this very chapter to Saul. So he makes reference to himself as the last of the judges, and the first of the kings is now standing there listening to this speech. And then in verses 12 and 13, he goes on to therefore speak about the sin of Israel in asking for a king, that they'd completely missed the lesson of the cycle of the judges. And here's what he says. He says, when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us when Yahweh your God was king. Now therefore behold the king whom ye have chosen and whom ye have desired. And Rotherham's emphasized both those words. The king whom ye have chosen and whom ye have desired. Behold, Yahweh hath set a king over you. You notice this, brothers and sisters, in verses 12 and 13. That although Samuel believed that the nation had sinned in asking for a king, that he doesn't say that a king shall reign over us when Samuel the seer was your judge. He's not worried about himself, is he? What he says is that you've sinned in asking for a king when Yahweh your God was your king. He's not worried about his own position. He's not seeking to vindicate himself. He was concerned that they hadn't appreciated the overpowering control of Yahweh in all the circumstances of their life. They hadn't learnt, you see, really, the lesson of the judges.
And so he says, look, what you've got to understand is this. He says, it doesn't matter whether you've got a king or whether you haven't got a king. Having a king is no guarantee of salvation. There's only one thing that will guarantee salvation in life, and that's the principle that I'm about to set before you in verses 14 and 15. King or no king, he says, if ye will fear Yahweh and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of Yahweh, then shall both ye and also the king that reigneth over you continue following Yahweh your God. But if ye will not obey the voice of Yahweh, but rebel against the commandment of Yahweh, then shall the hand of Yahweh be against you, and against your fathers, and the Septuagint adds, and against your king. And no doubt at that point he swung round and looked meaningfully at Saul, because this wasn't just an exhortation to the nation, it was very specifically an exhortation for the new king as well. That if you're not prepared to obey the commandment of God, then God's hand will be against you, against your fathers, and against your king. Obedience. You know, the word obey in verse 14 and in verse 15 is the word, it's the word Shema. It's the very word out of Samuel's name. Hear. But it's translated here as obey, and it's another meaning of the word Shema. If you will Shema the voice of God. And you see, what Samuel is really setting before them in the 14th and 15th verses is the great lesson of his own life. All my life, he says, I've heard God's voice. He says, that's the key to happiness. Doesn't matter whether you've got a king. It does matter whether you're prepared to be compliant to the voice of God in your life. That really is the key, he says. If you can't understand that, then he says you'll never find happiness. And this miracle of the thunder that follows from verses 16 to 19 was clearly designed by Samuel to illustrate that very lesson. Now let's just read on. It says in the 16th verse that he says, now therefore, stand and see this great thing which Yahweh will do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest today? I will call unto Yahweh, and he shall send thunder and rain, that ye may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which ye've done in the sight of Yahweh in asking you a king. Is it not wheat harvest today? Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 1. Now, notice what the proverb says in this context. Is it not wheat harvest today? Yet I will call unto Yahweh, and he shall send thunder and rain. We're told in Proverbs 26 verse 1, as snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honour is not seemly for a fool. Now, how seemly do you think honour is for a fool? How seemly is honour for a fool? Well, actually, when you think about it, it's two things. First of all, it's utterly incongruous. In fact, it's quite impossible. It's just not possible, is it? They're mutually exclusive terms. Honour and a fool. It just doesn't happen. Well, he says, that's what it's like to have rain in harvest. It doesn't happen. And the reference is to the fact that at this particular time of the year, which is round about sort of April, May of our own time, it's the Jewish month Ziv, there was week after week after week of blue skies and endless sun beating down upon the grain to ripen it with warmth and to bring it to fruition. There was never ever even a hint of rain.
There were clear blue skies for week after week. As rain in harvest, says the proverb, so is the likelihood of honour for a fool. It just doesn't happen. Well, says Samuel, so you think the impossible can't happen? It will. I will pray to God, and he will send thunder and rain at the very time when you expect that it cannot occur. So back in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 12, it says this in the 17th verse, that he shall send thunder and rain, that ye may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which ye've done in the sight of Yahweh in asking you a king. So Samuel called unto Yahweh, and Yahweh sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared Yahweh and Samuel. What a dramatic spectacle it must have been. Can you imagine that? Can you see the throngs of Israel? Can you see the old prophet there with his hands out, uplifted in supplication? The old man with his mantle and his flowing locks, and the shriek of his voice ascending up into the skies, as we're told that he prayed in a very unusual way. And all of a sudden, across the blue skies, there came the feel of coldness in the air. And then all of a sudden, the sign of black clouds upon the horizon. And then the spattering of rain. And finally, with an enormous thunderclap, a burst of thunder that came across the people. And do you know what the word thunder is in verse 17? Why, it's the very same word translated as the voice of God in verses 14 and 15. And in that dramatic, symbolic occasion, at last Israel heard the voice of God, because Samuel had brought it upon them. And they heard it like they'd never, ever heard it before. And we're reminded of the words, aren't we, of John chapter 12, verses 28 to 30, when the Lord, on the day of his own prayer to the Father, said, Father, glorify thy name. And the Father replied, saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it. And when they heard that voice, some said that an angel spake, others said that it thundered. Jesus said, this voice came not for my sake, but for yours. And that same principle was exhibited in the life of the Lord himself in John chapter 12. And the people of Israel heard the voice of God. That was ever the message of the prophet. You know, we're told in the next verse that Israel said, pray for thy servants unto Yahweh thy God, that we die not, for we've added unto all our sins this evil to ask us a king. If you come back to Exodus chapter 9, here's the spirit of that entreaty from Israel measured again against the life's experiences of Moses, that great and illustrious forebear of the prophet Samuel himself. In Exodus chapter 9 and verse 27, we have a measuring of the same spirit. It says there that Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said unto them, I have sinned this time. Yahweh is righteous and I and my people are wicked. Entreat Yahweh, for it is enough that there be no more mighty thunderings and hail. You notice the margin? Voices of God. And Pharaoh pleaded that Moses might lift up his hand in prayer to stop the mighty thunderings or the voices of God that cascaded all over Egypt out of the vault of heaven. And that's exactly what Samuel's asked to do by his own people in the 1st of Samuel chapter 12. Look, Samuel could just feel the spirit of Moses in him. He really was, in a very special sense, another one of those trailblazers, wasn't he? You know, there's a wonderful lesson that comes out of all this, and that's this. Some people in life and the truth only ever hear the voice of God when it thunders. They never hear its gentle whisper in the commonplace things of daily life. Some people are only ever touched by divine principles at fraternals and at meetings when the voice of God thunders from one side of the hall to the other. Everybody hears the voice then. But the lesson of Samuel's life was that he didn't need thunder out of the sky. Samuel heard that voice even as the quietest whisper in life. He always did. Do you? Are you sensitive to divine principles in all aspects of life? Or are we one of those people that it's got to be so obvious and so complete a scriptural matter before we'll bow to the divine voice? It's a lesson in that, isn't it? In the first of Samuel chapter 12 and verse 20, it says that Samuel said unto the people, "Fear not, ye have done all this wickedness, yet turn not aside from following Yahweh, but serve Yahweh with all your heart." We haven't got time to really do justice to the last few verses, and I just want to take a couple of things by way of exhortation out of them. So I'm going to sacrifice exposition for exhortation. You want to ask me some questions afterwards, please feel free to do so. But just look at this. In these verses, we really do have a man who gave himself to counselling the nation. You see where all those words came from? Chapter 12, verse 14, learning to fear God and serve him, that's Moses in Deuteronomy 6, verse 13. Learning to obey the voice of God, that's Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 43. Learning to serve Yahweh with all our heart, that's Moses in Deuteronomy 10, verse 12. Learning to not turn aside after the gods of the world, that's Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 16. Learning the good and the right way of the truth, that's Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 28. And the warning that if we intend to do wickedly in life, that one day God's retribution will inescapably come upon us, that's Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 30. And Samuel, the counselor of the nation, took all of his thoughts on that occasion, we believe, from the great resignation speech of Moses himself. Because is not the book of Deuteronomy the resignation speech of Moses? His farewell comments to the nation? And Samuel, whose mind was full of all those principles, draws virtually every key lesson that he wishes to impress upon the nation out of the writings of Moses. And I suppose what we learn out of that is that the principles of the truth never change, do they? If those were the things that Moses thought were important in life, and those were the things that Samuel, in the oldness of his age, felt were the most important things, then aren't they really the most important things for us today? And isn't it true that when it comes down to it, that that's what life and the truth is all about? Fearing God, obeying his voice, serving Yahweh with all our heart, being resolute that we should not turn aside to the gods of the flesh, desiring earnestly to do the good and right thing according to the truth, being ever mindful that Yahweh is a great and terrible God. Do you feel that way about the truth? That's what an old man wanted to say to his people. If it was important to Samuel, it should be important to us. In the 23rd verse, the record tells us that Samuel, in response to the request of the nation, said, "Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against Yahweh in ceasing to pray for you." You see, the people in verse 19 had said, "Pray for thy servants unto Yahweh thy God." But you notice that Samuel doesn't say, "God forbid that I should sin against you in ceasing to pray for you." He didn't see it as a sin against them. He saw it as a sin against God if he didn't lift up his voice in prayer for them. Now, that's an interesting principle, isn't it? And what we really have set before us, we believe, in verse 23, is the lesson of Samuel as an intercessor. You ever stop to think about what intercessorship is? You know, what intercessorship really is that time in life when we're free from fault in a matter. And someone else does have fault. You ever been in that situation in life? Have you ever had that experience in ecclesial life where you're free from fault in a matter and somebody else is at fault? Do you know what that gives us opportunity to do? It presents us with the wonderful opportunity of becoming an intercessor. That we can lift up our prayer of intercessorship for others. In a matter in which we ourselves have no fault. So that far from having opportunity that we might disparage our brethren when we see them at fault and we ourselves in that particular matter maybe have no blame. Far from giving us the opportunity that we might criticise our brethren, it gives us the opportunity that we might pray for them. Now here he is, and surely this is a lesson from the life of the prophet. Samuel the intercessor. Isn't that one of the lessons of his life? God forbid that I should cease to pray for you and so sin against my God. He saw his role as an intercessor as a joyful obligation in the church. And so we've said here that his name was indicative of the power of his prayers, heard of God. His prayers were characterized by a particular shriek or strident cry, which we're told of in the 1st of Samuel chapter 7 and verses 8 and 9. And there's an indication in Psalm 78 verse 65 that the prayers of Samuel were capable of arousing the divine response. In fact, there's a play upon the name in the 1st of Samuel chapter 7 verse 9 that Samuel cried unto Yahweh and Yahweh heard him, heard of God. Or in Psalm 99 verse 6, Samuel, among them that call upon his name, they called upon Yahweh and he answered them. Heard of God. That was the story of Samuel's life. He was a wonderful man and his whole ministry, as we can see here, was characterized by prayer to and converse with God. He was a man of prayer and he was a man of intercessory prayer. Come and have a look at Jeremiah chapter 14, not 15, 14. Jeremiah chapter 14. And just look at these marvellous words in the 19th verse. Hast thou utterly rejected Judah, laments Jeremiah the prophet? Hath thy soul loathed Zion? Why hast thou smitten us? And there is no healing for us. We look for peace, and there is no good, and for the time of healing, and behold the trouble. We acknowledge, O Yahweh, our wickedness, and the iniquity of our fathers, for we have sinned against thee. Do not abhor us for thy name's sake. Do not disgrace the throne of thy glory. Remember, break not thy covenant with us. Are there any among the vanities of the Gentiles that can cause rain? Or can the heavens give showers? Art not thou he, O Yahweh our God? Therefore we will wait upon thee, for thou hast made all things. You know, brothers and sisters, you won't find a more wonderful intercessory prayer in the scriptures than that of Jeremiah. You won't find a more wonderful, heartfelt, intercessory prayer than that of Jeremiah chapter 14, verses 19 to 22. As the prophet eloquently lifts up his voice that he might plead on behalf of his nation. And you know what the divine response was? Chapter 15, verse 1. God said to Jeremiah, "You think your prayers are good?" He says, "I tell you, even though Moses and Samuel stood before, I could not listen to this people." And for all the eloquence of the prayer of Jeremiah, the answer of God was that Moses and Samuel exceeded him for eloquence in praying on behalf of their nation. Now, brothers and sisters, how often do you pray for others? How often do you pray for other members of your family? How often in your prayers at home do you pray for the ecclesia? And when there's someone in the meeting in trouble, do you mention them in your prayers? And perhaps above all, when there's a matter of fault in ecclesial life, and through the grace of God, it just so happens that you're not involved, do you pray for those that are at fault? That's intercessory prayer. That's the lesson of the life of Samuel. Stop and think about it. You know, I think we could all do a lot more in our prayers. To pray for far more than just ourselves and our families and our wives and our good health. We need to learn to pray for others. That's the spirit of Samuel. What a grand lesson from an old man who truly given himself in every way for the needs of his people. And so the resignation speech of Samuel came to an end. Was full of wise counsel, full of many wonderful words. It was a speech that no doubt Israel would not forget for a long, long time. As an old man set before them all of the principles that he counted as dearest in his own heart. It was his desire that the king would prosper, that the nation would grow, that they might learn the lessons of his own life in hearing God and in being heard of God. The old prophet walked slowly away to Ramah, his hometown. There were many things for Israel and perhaps for ourselves to ponder concerning that day when Samuel called unto Yahweh and Yahweh sent thunder.